The hour of 12:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order Higher Education Finance and Policy. President Kaler's on a tight schedule, and we promised we would get him out of here by 1:30 so he could get to his next appointment. So welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record, and let's pick it up where we left off. And I think we're on page 10 of your PowerPoints.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Kaler from the University of Minnesota. We are on slide number 20, which, if you have double-sided, would be page 10 of your handout. I'd like to also acknowledge the presence of Regent Beeson today with us. I will pick up where I left off, and that is the research initiative we call MnDrive. But first, I want to clarify something I told you on Monday. You asked about the impact of the federal spending sequester on the university. And I said that it would be about $50 million to the university. And that figure was based on the original sequester reductions, or 8.4% cuts across the board. In January, however, Congress passed legislation that reduced the sequester rate to 5.1%. And that means the sequester impact on our research enterprise is lower. It will be about $31 million. So I apologize for giving you an accurate statement. Now on to MnDrive. Our goal on research, and the mandate really on our research, is to bring our discoveries to the marketplace for the common good. And we want to pick up the pace on that front. We propose a new comprehensive vision for discovery, research, innovation, and economic vitality in the state. And we call it MnDrive, short for the Minnesota Discovery Research and Innovation Economy Funding Program. MnDrive is really a roadmap for the great state to invest in a highly focused way on our university strengths, sparking discovery and tackling Minnesota and the world's most pressing problems, while at the same time fueling key Minnesota industry. In our budget request, we are seeking $18 million annually from the state for scientific research in four critical emerging fields. Those fields are already amongst the university's most exceptional scholarly and educational strengths, and they match up with the state's most pressing needs and emerging industries. Let me describe them to you quickly.
President Kaler, yes, sir. Just the $18 million, is this a base adjustment then that the university is requesting?
This would be an $18 million recurring, yes, sir.
All right, so the total then would be, and this goes to Representative Reinhardt's point at the last meeting, it's not actually $18 million that we're going to be budgeting for. We have to budget for 2 years and then one more on top of that. And no? You're
no,
shaking
I'm,
your head.
I'm,
all right.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
President Kaler.
Perhaps misspoke. We're looking for $18 million in each year of the biennium.
And that's, all right.
$36 million
for the biennium. So it is 36.
Yes.
Okay.
I apologize.
And when we return to doing the markup, we're going to ask for clarity, because next week there will be targets announced on Monday, members. So.
And I believe we have, Mr. Chairman, provided you with a breakdown of the four areas of
right.
investment that we would do that I will now describe to you. The first one is food. If you drive 10 miles in either direction from this room, you will arrive at the global headquarters of some of the world's largest and most respected food production and food manufacturing companies. From Cargill to General Mills to Land O'Lakes, we are blessed. Drive in a 100-mile circle from here and you'll be at the Hormel headquarters. Across the state, we have thousands of food producers, and about 20% of our state's economy is driven by agribusiness. We want to bring our expertise at the university to ensure a safe and sustainable food system and vibrant agricultural sector so that we will be a primary player in feeding the 9 billion people, many of them hungry, who will soon inhabit the earth. The outcome of MnDrive's food path is clear. We will be poised to be the home of innovation, the Silicon Valley of food technology, food safety, and food supply management. The second pillar of the MnDrive initiative is brain disorders and what's called neuromodulation. We can pioneer new technologies and applications for deep brain stimulation and confront conditions such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and even addiction. I know that our medical device industry in the state, which employs 29,000 people and that was given birth by the invention of the pacemaker on our campus, is eager to see us push this new frontier of neuromodulation technology. And with this knowledge, our patient care in Minnesota will be national leading. Thirdly, water quality and advancing industry. As a chemical engineer, I believe water will be the oil of the 21st century in the sense that people will fight wars over it. It's a resource that must be preserved and around which research will flourish. We at the university are a national leader in studying and seeking to solve environmental challenges posed by mining in northeastern Minnesota and around the state as fracking grows and by other industries. This is a perfect example of how we can help solve the state's problems while partnering with industry. And finally, robotics, sensors, and advanced manufacturing. I hope you saw the recent media coverage of the excitement among high school students in Minnesota around robotics. We want to make Minnesota a key player in this burgeoning scientific and industrial space and rejuvenate Minnesota's manufacturing economy while building on the U's traditional strength in engineering, material science, computer science, and robotics. Here's what MnDrive could mean and do for the innovation economy of the state. In robotics, we would add 15 new faculty, lab personnel, and graduate postdocs at a cost of about $4.25 million. In our food initiative, we would add 16 new faculty and other research and scientist staff positions. On the water piece of MnDrive, the plan is to add 13 faculty, 36 graduate research assistants, 15 postdocs, and among others, liaisons to industry so we understand the needs of the business community. And on the brain disorders, we would add 11 new faculty, new leaders in a neuromodulation clinic and laboratory. Add that all up, and that's the core of where your investment of $18 million would go. We also believe there will be great interest from industry, federal research agencies, and philanthropy. These MnDrive dollars will be heavily leveraged. New industries will flourish, existing industries will advance and adapt. A new cohort of master's and PhDs will be granted, attracting and retaining talent in this state as the competition is global and fierce. I expect you will ask me what would happen if the state does not partner with us to fund our MnDrive initiative. That would be a huge lost opportunity and send a signal to the investor, business, and scientific communities that Minnesota doesn't want to remain a center for innovation and entrepreneurialism. We are a state known for our commitment to innovation. It's no wonder we have 19 Fortune 500 companies, the second most per capita of any state in the United States. And in these MnDrive areas of potential discovery that I just detailed, we already have a competitive advantage. But without the state's investment and private dollars that we could leverage, other states will pass us by. There's the short-term loss of bringing top-notch faculty and top-notch graduate students to the state, along with the research grants that they would attract. But there's the long-term lost opportunity because of the lack of investment in innovation and research now, which will lead to fruits of discovery 10, 15, and 20 years down the road. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can't guarantee you that making an investment in MnDrive will let us make another life-saving medical discovery or a new strain of wheat as the university has done in the past. But I can guarantee you that if the state funding remains flat, if we don't recruit and support the best young faculty and the best young minds, we won't discover new things. Our business climate will tumble, as will our state's quality of life. Norman Augustine, the former CEO of Lockheed Martin, has the best quote on this subject. And it is, if you happen to find yourself on an airplane that is losing altitude, and you have to throw things out to stay aloft, the last thing you throw out is the engine. And the University of Minnesota is an engine of innovation and discovery for the state of Minnesota, and it deserves this investment.
President Kaler, yes, Representative Briner has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I wanted to ask in the MnDrive, you listed the potential for private partners, but I'm wondering how you would work across other public entities and semi-governmental entities that are already engaged in a number of these enterprises. We have regional centers across the state under other, engaging in some of these initiatives. So,
President Kaler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Representative. We are open for an innovative collaboration in all of those spaces. We don't want to be duplicative, and we understand that there may be venues where our research results can percolate, if you will, in the rest of the state. But the fundamental research we anticipate would be done at the university, and as we apply those research, we'll partner with anyone, private industry, NGOs, other state agencies, to move forward. And we have good records of doing it. Our transportation center and the Department of Transportation have collaborated well through the years. We're growing our collaboration with our MNSCU colleagues in the research space, so we're open to anything that makes sense and works.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm assuming that you do this in some capacity, too, but I think it's important for the public record that there would even be some type of a scan in each of these areas that you would begin your process with to see what is ongoing in the state and how you might best complement the work that's already engaged.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reinhardt, absolutely, and particularly in the robotics area, there's a ton, I was going to say, informally. Many, many activities going on, Robotics Alley and others. And just as in the life science space, we've partnered with Life Science Alley and others. We're tightly connected with those activities, and we want to leverage everybody to the best advantage.
Representative Johns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Taylor, what was the process for deciding these four emerging areas that you've selected?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson. Process went like this. I wanted to have some new research initiatives to advance on our strengths, and I asked our Vice President for Research, former Vice President for Research, Tim Mulcahy, to pull together deans and thought leaders, senior faculty across the university to vet these ideas. My guidance was that I wanted between 3 and 5 of them, and I wanted one of them at least to be in the medical space. And so we surveyed where we were, and these ideas came forward through that process. The other guideline that I should mention is I wanted these to be areas of strength of the university. I don't want to start from scratch. I want us to move from good to great, but also that intersected with the needs of the state of Minnesota. I think the food and water ones are fairly obvious. If you know about the robotics industry growing, that's a pretty good one. In neuromodulation, given the aging population and our already strong space there, was an easy pick for medical. There are half a dozen more that didn't make the cut, and I'd be happy to come back and ask for money for all of those, too. But we also aim to bring a request forward that we think is fundable.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response. Then, regarding outcomes, I see you have outcomes for the different areas. Will you be coming back then? Can we expect some outcome information regarding these four emerging areas as you cite here?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we are keenly focused on outcomes. If these don't thrive for one reason or another, then we will refocus resources in areas that will thrive. The outcomes are, in most of these cases, fairly easy to document. We're going to hire faculty. We will expect those faculty to bring in external research dollars to the state of Minnesota from the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health. Those are easy to benchmark. We expect them to generate scientific research results, publish peer-reviewed papers, which are easy to document. We expect some, but not all, will lead to invention disclosures and inventions that we will move into the public sector. So documentation and benchmarking on these things is easy to do, and we will do it.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you, President Kaler. So, for example, will you be bringing information back about where you talk about growth of a new high-tech industry cluster, that information back then, where these clusters are and what they entail, and you'll get down more to the basic.
Sure.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we can absolutely bring you any information you'd like to see on the outcomes of these. And innovation is both in some sense hard and easy to measure. It's not generally an individual sport. It's a team sport. So you bring an invention disclosure forward, and you're able to get a patent or other protection for the intellectual property, but then you partner with larger infrastructure, and our success in robotics, for example, would depend on success of other people innovating in the robotics space. We're happy to take credit where credit is assignable, but sometimes it's difficult upon the individual assessment. I don't mean to dodge your question, but I do believe we'll be a force for innovation in ways that we can document.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, you bring up a point that has been reoccurring since the very beginning of our hearings. I'm hopeful we will have language and statute so it will be automatic reporting on all of this for all of higher ed. So we won't have to ask the question. It will be an automatic that they'll come back and tell us. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, President Kaler. I like the areas that you picked, my initial thought, and going from good to great sounds like a good strategy to me versus going from scratch. But, you know, just one quick question on those areas. I've just done a little bit of reading on these new printers now that you can make a car, and you can, is that, does that fall under that advanced manufacturing?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, indeed, we actually have a very healthy research area, particularly in our College of Design, around three-dimensional printing. That is an advanced manufacturing technique that would be impacted at some level, and frankly, I don't know the details at that level to guarantee you where we would intersect that, but that's an example of an advanced automated manufacturing technique.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just find it to be an intriguing area. I've just read a few articles about it, and it just seems, Star Wars-like to me, I guess, to a certain degree. The other thing I do have a question about, and again, I get emails and information, and I got some information from an individual who said that non-faculty at the university, this particular job classification, which was fixing things, that they get 12 weeks of vacation a year and 6 weeks of sick time, okay? And I don't know if that's completely true or not. I usually like to check out, get a second opinion. Maybe you can advise me on that. But my point being this, is there an initiative underway to do a comparison between private sector responsibilities of salaries and benefits compared to government-subsidized institutions so that, having been on the school board, what we found was over a period of time, the benefits and especially the benefit structures seemed to get way out of whack, negotiated over a period of time in good faith, okay? But when we did a comparison with private sector responsibilities, we found that our benefit structure was way, way out of whack for our district area for similar type responsibilities in the private sector. So what that forced us to do was we privatized our cooks, we privatized the custodians, we privatized the bus drivers. Almost all of them got hired back, and those were tough decisions. Almost all of them got hired back at similar salary, but their benefit structure was reduced and more comparable to the private sector in our district. So is there any initiative to do some comparable work in that area? You might find out you save $18 million, okay? Just a thought. But I think that over time, and I don't want to make a sermon out of this, but over time, when you have government-subsidized institutions, the benefits can get out of balance with the people that are paying the bills. And if you'd like to respond to that.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, fortunately, my Vice President for Human Relations, Kathy Brown, is here, and she can provide an authoritative answer if we could welcome her to the table.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Catherine Brown, and I'm the Vice President for Human Resources at the University of Minnesota. Chair Pulaski, Representative, we do regular studies of our compensation and compare that to the private sector. I think your conclusions are probably accurate that our benefit structure in terms of leaves is a little higher than the average in the private sector. We have done very aggressive comparisons in our benefits area and have done a great deal to reduce the cost of benefits for our employees and try to bring that within a more even keel. But even in that area, there probably is more work to examine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gurney.
Oh, just thank you for that response. And just a quick follow-up. The example that was given to me of 12 weeks of vacation and 6 weeks of sick time for a non-faculty position, do you think that's realistic?
Ms. Brown.
Yes, Chair Pulaski, Representative. Without knowing the specific job classification, it's hard for me to say with certainty. That sounds a little bit more rich than what I would expect it to be. But we do have accrual based on hours worked for our hourly employees and so forth, and they are able to accrue vacation. The 12 weeks sounds richer than I think would be our top accrual rate, but without knowing the particular circumstance, I can't say with certainty.
Representative Gurney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could get that information to me, you know, and in as simplified a form as possible, just for comparative purposes, mm-hmm. I'd appreciate it.
Yes.
Thank you.
We'd be glad to do that.
Representative Narnes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just wanted to thank President Kaler for his presentation, and had a student in my office today who is headed to the university campus next year.
Okay.
He's a senior in high school in Fergus Falls. Just wanted you to tell let you know you got one more student from my community heading your way. So I guess what I wanted to add here is that hopefully the targets will be favorable when we get them. And what interests me, it's all interesting, I guess, when you look at the future you've laid out, but the health care, and particularly Alzheimer's, has a specific target, really interests me a lot. So hopefully that can be one of the breakthroughs that the university can deal with, hopefully, in the near future. And one more thing, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to throw out here. I heard on the radio something interesting today, that this is just for those engineers that are graduating from the university. There's an engineer in Canada that just invented a device that does nothing. So, and it's really catching on, apparently, as a novelty. So, you don't have to go there. That's something the university does not have to worry about. That's already been invented, so it does nothing. So, thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have three quick points, and one I may have missed, but in your accountability and performance slide, on the fourth one, you talk about maintaining a 2000 level of National Science Foundation recorded R&D expenditures. Is there any concern about that given sequestration and perhaps funding at the federal level?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, yes, there's a ton of concern about that. That's why, while it sounds like a modest goal, it's actually quite a stretch goal. And our hope and plan is to make it, but it is not a slam dunk.
Okay, and
Representative
thank you.
Norton.
And you do say 3 out of 5, and, you know, so I suppose that gives you a little wiggle room on that one, but I was concerned about that. Day before yesterday, when you presented last, you had the slide on the administrators and the miscoded faculty, and we didn't talk about that at the time, but I guess I would ask you, even though some were, whether your fault or the reporter's fault, that some of them were not supported by state and tuition funds, I guess I would still question of those that were paid for by non-state and tuition funds, were they indeed administrators?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, my understanding is, yes, they are. I have a colleague here who can give a little more background to that if you would like, but my understanding is, yes, they are administrators.
Okay, so
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess the concern still remains whether they're paid for out of state and tuition funds, and perhaps the report, you know, and the work that's being done in that area, and I know you're scrutinizing that area, could still be looked at, that whether they be grants or funded outside, that we try to review carefully whether they all need to be administrators or whether there's a, you know, a little different level of funding that could be done for non-administrative staff and still have a nice salary that would entice someone to come here would be looked at. And my last one, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not going to ask a question necessarily, but as you know, we do get emails, we do get phone calls, some of us have called and gotten some information, that as your HR department reviews some of the packages and what have you, that you continue to look at pensions. I know there's a grand variety of pensions depending on the level of the employee, but some of them are, I would say, outside the realm probably of even the private sector, and that you might want to give a real close look at those as a way to tighten up your budget in the future.
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, I will say, and I don't want to be defensive of the administrative load we carry, but I will say that when we have externally funded projects, they're by and large peer-reviewed. There's enormous pressure on those budgets at the NIH or the NSF, so there's a very careful justification of what a person is doing there. A principal investigator rarely has the luxury to decide, I'll just hire somebody because I want to, and that's not really a job. Unfortunately, the word administrator has been made a pejorative in a lot of these conversations. These are people who do incredibly important jobs and are critical to the mission of the university. So they do important work. And sometimes, for example, the auxiliary services that fund some of these, dining or parking, we will apply the same spans and layers analysis that we're doing. And in terms of pension, the philosophy before I arrived at the university was to be somewhat under-competitive in salary and compensate for that to create a competitive compensation package overall with a pension plan that looks a little better. We are looking very hard at that philosophy, both in terms of its overall attractiveness, particularly to younger employees, and its appropriateness. So I take your comment to heart.
Representative Norton.
And I really appreciate your feedback on that and that you're taking to heart our comments. And I do want to say, much as this committee and I myself have taken you on and others on with some perhaps harsh criticism, I just hope you understand that I think all of us around the table feel that the university is a huge asset, and you've done a wonderful job since you've been here. And, you know, we feel very proud of our university, and we just want it to remain the jewel that it is for the state. So the criticism is not meant to be hurtful. It's meant to be helpful, although I'm sure it doesn't feel that way all the time.
President Kaler, I asked some questions at the end of the last meeting, so I'm going to start today. The governor's budget is less than what you had initially requested. So can you tell us how the governor's number would impact what you presented to us?
So, yes, Mr. Chair, and if you let me answer that question, and I have a couple of more points to make on my PowerPoint, if you
okay.
don't mind.
Go ahead.
What's missing from the governor's proposal is essentially $11.5 million in support of our accountability fund, which rewards us for achieving the five key metrics that Representative Norton just mentioned. They would increase graduation rates from the Twin Cities campus, increase financial aid, increase new patent disclosures, and guarantee a certain amount of degrees granted and maintenance of our research funding. Those accountability fund dollars would be invested in a venture fund for new startups and in student services, among other areas. So that is the biggest difference between our request and the governor's $80 million allocation. The final few points, and I will be quick because I want to stand for your questions. The final portion of what we're asking is to help prepare the talents needed for health professional students in Greater Minnesota. Unfortunately, our health professional students graduate with heavy debt. And if they choose to serve in underserved areas, they're frequently unable to earn the salaries they would otherwise be receiving. And so to help them, we're proposing an increase of $1.5 million in the university's appropriation to help forgive student loans if they practice health care in underserved areas for a three-year period. We would reduce their debt by 15% a year for a total debt reduction of $39 million. One other thing, in his budget, Governor Dayton has included funds to increase the state grants program, and we support that proposal as another tool to help the state's college students. Let me close with a request in a historic context. In the year 2001, the university was funded with about $600 million. Since then, we've added 9,000 students. We've established the innovative and growing Rochester campus. We've seen our research enterprise grow by 40% in the last 5 years alone. We're living through a revolution in technology that we must continually update to students, faculty, and employees. But as the graph in front of you shows, if you were to fund our full request, the amount in 2015 would be $604.7 million, almost exactly what we received 14 years ago, not adjusted for inflation. You asked me also, Mr. Chair, another question at Monday's hearing. You asked me what would happen to tuition if the legislature does not increase funding to the university. We need a strong partnership, but the $42.6 million biennial math, 14.2 a year base, is a consequence, that number is a consequence of a careful budget process at the university, and it is what we need to operate the university. My goal is to receive that funding from the state and to be able to freeze tuition for Minnesota resident undergraduates. But if we're not able to receive that, we will have to increase tuition. That $42.6 million represents a 3% tuition increase each year of the biennium. That would still be the lowest rate of increase in more than a decade. My increase last year was historically low. I don't want to do that, and I very much hope that you can help me not have to do that with this funding request. Why is this? It's because we have cost drivers at the university that are unavoidable. And in order to maintain the excellence of what we do and provide the quality education that we do, we need to cover these costs. They're in new technology, recruitment and retention of faculty, building operations, utilities, rising health care benefits, and labor costs, instructional equipment, library costs, which are astronomical, safety and security, and student services, among other cost drivers. I will do everything I can to keep any increase as low as possible, and I've given you the numbers that indicate where we are. And with that, Mr. Chair, I believe I've completed my presentation. I'll stand for your questions.
President Kaler, thank you. I have another question on this. Let's assume the target is significantly less, $42.6 million. What's your priority, tuition or spending on new program and letting tuition continue to rise?
I would look, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to dodge this question. I would look very carefully at what would happen in the state grant program. We have the lowest cost for $75,000 and under net price, as I showed you on Monday. And I would look at the cost structure in our tuition pool. I might propose a modest across-the-board tuition increase and use some of those dollars to seed the innovation fund. Depending on the impact on our students, I might simply freeze tuition. I recommend to freeze tuition to the regents and not invest in research, put a pause on research at this point in time. But my preference is to minimize tuition increases, and whether I would use that 42.6 to solely do that would depend on other players. But if we received 42.6, tuition increases would be quite minimal.
I appreciate the answer. We have not cut the grant program during the period where public higher ed has been cut, historically cut. That program has been protected. And I can understand you'd look at the grant program if there was new money in the grant program. I'm not anticipating any particular target, but from the very beginning, I have tried to say that we should be prepared for the worst. And if we get anything above that, we can deal with it. But I want to make sure everybody understands we may get a very hard number. My last question is this one. Even to do that modest increase is going to take a significant increase in revenue. Assuming we stay with fixing the structural imbalance of the state, that's our first priority. Can you tell me what amount you think we should raise in revenue to fund your request?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I can answer that at a global statewide budget number, but I consistently say that my belief is that the state should put higher education at a higher priority than it has been and fund it adequately because it is the future of the state. Our request laid out in full at $92 million and the governor's number of $80 million represent what I think is a fair allocation to the university in this biennium.
To do $80 million at least in his initial budget, the governor raised $3.7 billion. Now, granted, there were other things funded, but that was his budget. Whatever we do here is going to have to take a significant increase in revenue, too. So my question is, and this is going to be for everyone when we get done with this, is will you, as the university and as the president, support increases in revenue to fund your own budget?
Mr. Chair, yes, I will.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. President Kaler, I just had a question about the underserved and health care. That request for $1.5 million annually, is that on top of money that's presently available for loan forgiveness? Or that's not the sum total?
President Kaler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there is a program which I believe is in the Department of Health, which is, let me, if you don't mind me asking Vice President Fitzenreuter to join, he knows this. I believe it is down in the Department of Health. I don't think it's funded. This would be in addition to that, but that Department of Health number is also small.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Richard Fitzenreuter, the Chief Financial Officer at the University of Minnesota. Our $1.5 million request is for a loan forgiveness program for students in the Academic Health Center, as well as veterinary students, which there is no current state program for veterinary students. There was some money provided by the legislature years ago, one-time money, but there's no current program. There are a couple of programs, one in particular in the, well, in the Department of Health. Two of those are very small federal programs, almost non-existent money in those programs, and in another loan forgiveness program that's managed by the Department of Health for health professionals, but not veterinary students. And that program was and is, I think, primarily funded out of MinCare dollars. It peaked at somewhere in the neighborhood of, I have it here, $1.3 million in roughly 2005, and sits at about $740,000 today. It doesn't meet the needs of very many students.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you have any documentation as to, I mean, I think it's a serious issue, this whole underserved in the healthcare, and something that the university can address. Have you found this particular program to be effective and have any data to demonstrate that?
Mr. Fitzenreuter.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Department of Health program, I think they would say in our discussions with them that that's been a very successful program to place students. It simply is constrained by dollars. The need is clearly there. This $1.5 million, buying down 15% of a health professional's student loan debt, provided they've made a 3-year commitment, would place between 23 to 25 students in these underserved areas of the state, which would be an enormous help, we think, and a very attractive program for the students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I struggled a little bit about making this comment, but with the talk about the need for additional revenue, I just thought I'd make this observation. You know, one of the things I've come to believe is that we're one of the richest states in natural resources in the whole nation, okay? Equal to North Dakota for sure, or better. I'll just give one example. Is up in Ely, Minnesota, according to the University of Minnesota geologist, there's a minimum of $1 trillion of minerals up by Ely, with the potential of $2 trillion of minerals up by Ely, Minnesota. My point is this. I talked to Twin Metal CEO, or executive. He said it's going to take them, they've spent $160 million trying to get a permit, and they want to do it in an environmentally friendly way, but they expect to spend $2.5 billion over 10 to 12 years to get a permit to tap into those resources. My suggestion is that we've got some of the strictest environmentalist laws in the nation, and I want clean water, and I want a clean environment. But the point is, I think it's reached an extremist position in our state where it's detrimental to our businesses and we're chasing them out of the state. To the degree that the university can provide us research and recommendations on how to balance environmental quality with the ability for industry to tap into our resources, which will generate hundreds of millions of billions of dollars of revenue so we can cover our pension plans, we can fund our university, and we can do all those things. If you could bring that into balance, I would sincerely appreciate it within about 1 year, if possible. No.
Mr.
President Chair.
Representative, I think you just endorsed our water initiative in MnDrive very effectively, and I thank you for doing that.
All right. Any further questions? President Kaler, thank you. We'll be revisiting you as we begin to put the budget bill together. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me.
Next on the agenda, we'll have the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, Chancellor Rosenstone. There he is. He just came in. We'll be presenting their budget request. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record, and then why don't you tell us which one. I think you have three different sources. You're going to be working from parts of both of them. So, members, we're not going through all of this, but he's selected the most important. So,
Chair Pulaski, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Rosenstone. I'm Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I'm going to be working today from actually two documents, one that says working together for Minnesota's prosperity, just a plain black and white set of handouts. And also we'll refer you to the bounded volume that's in color, spiral bound.
You need to have the technology on, Chancellor?
I'm not going to be working with technology. Okay, we'll just have great. Our conversation, work with the handout, if that's okay. Well, it's a pleasure to be back with you again today. Thank you for the opportunity this time to discuss the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities legislative request, a request that is focused on ensuring that Minnesotans from all walks of life have access to an extraordinary, affordable education that prepares them for jobs and careers, the jobs and careers needed across communities in our state for them to thrive. I'd like to recognize several trustees that are here today. Clarence Hightower, Chair of our Board of Trustees, Brett Anderson, Trustee Dawn Erlinson, Trustee Alfredo Oveda, Trustee Luis Sundin, and Trustee Michael Vekic are all here today to join. I would also like to recognize students, faculty, and staff who are here as well as many, as well as the many who are listening online across the state. This past year, we joined with DEED, with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and with other partners to hold 55 listening sessions across the state that engaged more than 1,500 people and 700 business leaders to help us understand the workforce needs of the future. Both the technical and foundational skills, things like teamwork and communication and creativity and analytical capacity needed for Minnesota to thrive. This past year, we also listened to our students and our dedicated faculty and staff who participated in forums on every one of our college and university campuses, forums designed to identify the next steps needed for great programs to become extraordinary and for extraordinary programs to become preeminent. And we listened to our savvy staff identify opportunities to improve efficiency and boost the quality of the work we do. And we listened to our presidents and our chief academic officers and deans and diversity officers describe the next steps we should take to improve student success and improve the quality of the education that we provide. And we listened to better understand the answer to an important yet simple question. What does Minnesota need to prosper? And throughout our deliberations, we have worked to ensure that our priorities and the focal point of our legislative request remains on the 430,000 students our colleges and universities do serve. As you will see, our request will enable us to deliver the outcomes that Minnesota needs to prosper. The budget we're proposing meets our obligation to address the needs of our students. It will deliver outcomes required to keep Minnesota competitive and communities across our state economically vibrant. Importantly, our request also is cognizant of the fiscal constraints that our state faces and the need for MinSCU to be actively participating in addressing those fiscal challenges. As you'll see, our budget will propose a shared funding strategy that does not solely rest upon the state, but rather a three-way partnership that leverages our own cost reductions and efficiencies, private contributions, and student support. I would like to convey the Board of Trustees' commitment to this proposal that we'll be discussing today. I bring these priorities forward on behalf of the Board, which has unanimously endorsed each element of the legislative request. Minnesota faces an urgent challenge, and the challenge is that we need to dramatically increase the number of people with a post-secondary credential. 70% of all the jobs that need to be filled in Minnesota by the year 2018 will require post-secondary credentials, half of them requiring a baccalaureate degree, half of them requiring certificates or diplomas. As the baby boom generation retires over the next 5 years and the workforce grows, there will be 620,000 job openings that need to be filled with employees with a post-secondary credential, half of the baccalaureate, half a certificate or diploma. And if we do nothing and remain on our current path, we will be 150,000 people short of the number of educated workers Minnesota needs to thrive. As state economist Tom Stinson put it in his legislative testimony on February 19th, quote, "Unlike any time in the world's history, labor and talent are going to be scarce resources. We don't have to worry about finding enough jobs for the people that are potentially able to work. We need to be able to find enough workers for the jobs out there." He went on to say, "We need to change our thinking from attracting jobs to being able to provide the skilled workers that our employers need. If our employers can't get the workforce they need in Minnesota," Stinson concludes, "they will be forced to look elsewhere for opportunities. Together, we must address this challenge. We must develop the world's best workforce here in Minnesota. It's essential to advancing Minnesota's prosperity." Our proposal is designed to advance the outcomes listed on page 2 of that black and white handout. Provide academic programs that meet the workforce needs and ensure that our graduates have the skills needed for the work that needs to be done. Deliver graduates in critical high-demand professions, particularly serving low-income, first-generation, and communities of color. Produce graduates trained on state-of-the-art equipment and technologies. Protect affordability and ensure that more students complete their education in a timely and cost-effective fashion. We're advancing three priorities that we must deliver for Minnesota to prosper. First, we must advance the competitiveness of Minnesota's workforce, not only by graduating more students, but more students with both those foundational skills and technical skills needed for the work that needs to be done. Secondly, we must ensure that high-quality programs remain affordable and within reach for students of diverse backgrounds to enable more students to enroll in post-secondary education and to finish with modest debt, if any. And third, we must accelerate completion of certificate, diploma, and degree programs. More students must finish, and more must finish in a timely fashion. I want to take these up very briefly, one by one. There's a one-page summary on page 2 of this booklet, which you can refer to. And if you want to look ahead, you can look at any even-numbered page in this booklet to see the impact of these three priorities on any one of the colleges or universities in the system. And then the black and white sheet will simply work us through point by point those priorities. Our first priority focuses on the competitiveness of Minnesota's workforce. It's about delivering the world's best workforce. There's an urgent need to train students at our colleges and universities on state-of-the-art equipment. This initiative builds upon the 2012 pilot program that this legislature appropriated funds for, $457,000 in the last session, was matched by $731,000 in private contributions. We want to scale up this very successful program statewide. We again want dollar-for-dollar matches to the legislative support that we're asking for. This initiative, like each of the initiatives we'll be discussing, has an accountability metric that says that if we are unable to raise at least $7.5 million by April of 2014, the FY15 funds should not be released. With respect to internships, we've heard from both our students and from businesses about the importance of internships. Huge support in these listening sessions across the entire state. It's a recommendation from the Itasca Higher Education Task Force report. It's a priority that our students have talked to me about. Internships provide real hands-on world learning experiences for colleges and university students across our state. They prepare students for careers and jobs. They connect students with businesses in the local community, and they provide financial support to students to help with affordability and completion. Our proposal calls for an internship program that would have a dollar-for-dollar match to the state support that we're requesting. And if so, we can provide $1,500 paid internships to a total of 10,000 students by 2015.
Chancellor?
Yes, sir.
On the internship point, when you were doing your listening sessions, you said the employers supported the internships?
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, the employers supported the idea of the need for internships and seemed very willing to provide matching grants to the state support.
Did you subsequently say that it would take a significant increase in revenue in order to fund these internships? And then what was their response if you asked that question?
Chair Pawlowski, I did not ask that question.
Chancellor Rosenstone, that question has been asked repeatedly since the beginning of session. And the answer that I'm getting is they don't support it if we have to increase revenue. And that's a critical component of everything we're doing here. This doesn't work unless we increase revenue. So this one in particular is an interesting one, because when the internship issue is brought up, there's hardly anyone that says, well, we wouldn't like it, but if it caught, and I'm talking about employers now, if we have to raise revenue to get it, they say there are other ways it couldn't be done. So I'm bringing it up as a concern, particularly in this component.
Thank you.
Okay.
With respect to faculty-driven educational innovations, over the past years, I mentioned faculty on every MNSCU campus met to discuss the question, what does an extraordinary education look like? Our students also met in statewide assemblies to discuss the same questions. Students have told us that they want innovations in teaching that will help them prepare for collaborative work in a networked world. Many faculty have told us that they're eager to integrate more technology into their teaching, but they need help to do so. We want to scale up some of the best practices that exist at some of our colleges and universities across the entire state. We're asking for your help, $4 million in FY14, $4 million in FY15, to enable colleges and universities to move forward with transforming teaching and learning in a way that will benefit all students. Over the biennium, we were able to implement at least 100 major course redesigns and high-impact courses. By that I mean introductory and other gateway high-enrollment courses. We expect that instructional design and technology training and support will be delivered to a significant proportion of our faculty throughout the system. And these educational innovations will require about a three-month startup, the hiring of the design teams necessary to work with faculty to provide this support. Some of those will be faculty themselves who are on reassignment. We'll be able to launch in 2013.
With respect to your... Representative Poppy has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Related to the faculty-driven educational innovations and the accountability measure on that, what additional inputs are likely to change in order to get that outcome? I just look at that and think, okay, the graduates increase by 3.5%. Will you be adjusting the students who are coming in? Will you be adjusting doing things differently for the input in order to get to this? Or is it only going to be related to faculty innovations?
Chancellor Rosenstrike.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Poppe, excellent question. If we just hold on for a few minutes, you'll see some of the inputs that I hope we also are able to change. But clearly being able to give the tools to our faculty, be able to have the leading edge technology and the internship experiences together, I think will produce a huge jump in our ability to place students in the chosen field or related field. We're projecting about a 3.5% jump there.
Representative Poppe.
I'll wait and see if I receive that. Thank you.
Okay. Receive that.
Our second initiative concerns, second priority concerns, access and affordability. We're going to be driving more efficiencies over the biennium. The Board of Trustees, as well as our college and university system leadership, have had a longstanding commitment to control costs and protect access and affordability. As we discussed in previous sessions, Minsky ranks 40th out of 50 comparable state systems in the U.S. in overall administrative spending per student. The system office is 24% smaller than it was 4 years ago, and there are fewer administrators in the system office than there was a decade ago. The system began with 43 presidents. When it was formed in 1995, we're down to 31 presidents now. Responsibilities have expanded. Our long-term commitment to cost control will be realized over the next biennium with an additional $44 million in efficiencies. Last year, we embarked on the fundamental redesign of our business practices system-wide for finance, for human resources, for financial aid processing and procurement, and we're committed to use these efficiencies to help hold costs down over the next biennium. Our academic programs will continue to go through their thorough program review process, and there will be opportunities to close programs that have low demand but high costs. Altogether, we'll be able to generate $44 million of efficiencies over the biennium.
Chancellor, on the $44 million, we've already had a discussion, and you've already stated that the you're going to ask the trustees to take action on the bonuses. Has that proposal been sent to the trustees yet, and have they taken action on that?
Chair Pawlowski, my pledge to you was that I would be submitting that proposal to the board before the end of session. I'm anticipating that it will be at the April meeting of the board. The proposal has been drafted. We've consulted with our presidents on it and have consulted with individual board members. So I will indeed be following through on the pledge that they made to you and members of the committee.
Thank you very much.
With respect to high-demand programs, if we're going to meet the pressing workforce needs that Minnesota is confronting, there are some programs that simply must grow. And what we're suggesting is a very targeted investment in those high-demand, high-growth programs. We can't do this by ourselves. Even with the cuts that have occurred in state support, state funds still support 31% of the cost of any program, with students supporting with their tuition dollars 61% of the remaining costs. Our goal is to make very targeted investments in high growth areas, and by 2018 to be able to serve 3,400 students, producing 600 additional graduates. There's a pipeline issue, so things ramp up gradually, but by the year 2021, this investment will serve 4,800 additional students and will produce approximately 2,100 graduates a year. We're asking for help with $3 million in FY14 and $7 million in 2015. Accountability metric here as well. We anticipate being able to have in place 20 new or expanded programs that will be enrolling students by a year from this September. If not, the accountability metric would not allow the funds for FY15 to be released, and we're prepared to move forward effectively on this. The board's proposal also proposes modest tuition increases. Students in Minnesota have numerous options when they're considering higher education. Our strategy is to remain the state's highest value, most affordable option. Under the board's proposal, the board is committed to modest tuition increases capped at $145 a year for full-time students at our colleges and $205 a year for full-time students at our universities. Access and affordability is not only protected through the modest tuition increase, but also through additional steps the board is taking. First, the completion of a statewide scholarship campaign to raise at least $20 million in scholarships that will serve over 16,000 students across the state. Second, affordability should be addressed by going after the bias that currently exists against part-time students in the state's grant program formulas. Our board is asking that the formula, funding formula, change to open the benefits of this program to more than 9,900 part-time working students with financial need across the entire state who are currently excluded from this state grant program. This proposal will help not only part-time working students with financial need who attend a Minsky institution, but part-time working students with financial need that attend other colleges and universities in the state. Simply put, we cannot provide access to higher education or provide the workforce that Minnesota needs if students with financial need, who out of necessity have to work part-time but cannot get access to the state grant program. This change to the state grant program will help ensure success for students traditionally who've been underserved by higher education and help for students who are struggling to cross the finish line in a more timely fashion.
Chancellor Rosenthal, before you leave this page, under modest tuition increases, can you give me the percent number for each year of the biennium that would be? What are we looking at in a percent? Is it 1%, 2%, 3%?
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, it will average approximately 3%. Some colleges will be less than that. Some universities will be less than that.
And that's each year.
Yes,
so it would be 6% over the biennium. Okay.
Now, if you go to the next slide.
And let's just hold it 1 second. Under the grant program, do you know what that costs to do the part-time students?
Chair Pawlowski, yes, I do.
And what would that be?
For the students that would be served in Minsky over the 2 years of the biennium, it would be $23 million.
That's over the biennium?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that leads us to the very next slide, slide six. And this is from the get-go how the board thought about protecting affordability. So we are not, Chair Pawlowski, just simply saying let's raise tuition by $145 and $205. But there's a strategy to try to, if you will, buy down that tuition. It was not a strategy that put the entire responsibility on the state of Minnesota, but says that we must take some responsibility for finding the funds to help cushion that tuition increase. So the internships, both the money from the state, but also the matching funds that we're trying to get, will provide $24 million to our students. The scholarships that are going to be private dollars that we're raising will provide another $20 million to our students. And access to the straight grant for working part-time students within our system would provide $23 million. So if you take the total dollars of the tuition increase over the biennium and then subtract these investments to help on the affordability front, that moves the annual tuition increase on average, some students will be more, some will be less, but on average moves it to $20.45 for college students and $28.91 for university students.
Again, Chancellor, excuse me again, Representative Carlson has a question. And
Mr. Chairman, Chancellor, that $20 million that you're going to raise, could you just briefly expand a little bit on how you're going to do that? And I'll tell you why I'm raising the question. I had a conversation a few years ago with one of your predecessors who indicated that it was very difficult to raise dollars for the system, and that you were much more successful when you raised the dollars by encouraging people to contribute to a given campus. So I'm curious as to what your take on raising that $20 million. Are you talking system-wide or by campus?
Chancellor Rosenthal.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative Carlson, excellent question. This is not Steve trying to raise funds for the Minsky Foundation. This is a coordinated effort of all of our college and university foundations doing the fundraising. I am there to assist in that. But no one graduated from Minsky. No one will ever graduate from Minsky. They graduate from Winona State University or Mankato or Moorhead or Alexandria Technical College. But we have engaged in a coordinated effort, consulting with all the foundation directors and foundation boards and advancement folks on all the campuses. And we together are committed to raising these private funds. This is a doable number.
Representative Carlson.
That's fine.
I have Representative Lean next, and then Representative Franzens after that. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Rosenthal, I just have a question just to clarify how you say provide more access to the state grants for part-time students, because I've heard a couple different proposals how that may be done. One would be to prorate the state grant based on the number of credits Another would be to set the part-time or the full-time status at 12 credits. Can you just provide some clarification there?
Chancellor Rosenstein.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, the proposal that I'm most familiar with is one that says that if you're taking 50% of full-time credit, you get 50% of the state grant. That's precisely what the Pell Grant does, but our state formula does not do that. It's very common that state formulas do precisely what the Pell Grant formula does with respect to the proration. And all we're saying, if you're taking 50% of full-time credits, get 50% of the state grant. If you're taking 75%, get 75%. If you're only taking a third, get a third of the state grant, as opposed to falling off very quickly, to sometimes getting zero, even if you're taking a third of a full-time student load. So it's changing the formula to stop, if you will, the discrimination against the part-time students. And one of the things that's happened over the last 5 years is that there's been a tremendous increase in the number of students who have had to go part-time. That's in part a function of the populations we need to serve that we haven't traditionally served, that need to be served by higher education. And it's also a function of what the economy's been like for the last 5 years. Families have been less able to provide support they have in the past, and more students have been forced to go part-time just to hold body and soul together, given the lack of that family support or other life circumstances. And so the reality is, if we need to be serving students differently than in the 70s when this program was created, and if the financial circumstances of our students have changed, we need to respond in a way that doesn't shut those students out, slow down their pace to graduation, or really create financial problems for those students compared to those who can afford to go full-time.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question, Chancellor Rosenstone. That $20 million cost, you said that would be just the NCU system or including the U of M, the privates?
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pawlowski, members, if I'm not mistaken, the $23 million that's on that slide would be the dollars that would go to Minsky students. Minsky students are approximately 8,000 of the 9,900 students, so we'd have to do a little math to find out what the total cost is of this change to the state grant program. But not all the funds go to Minsky students. Students in private institutions at the University of Minnesota who go part-time would also benefit from the state grant change.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chancellor Rosenstone, when I'm looking at the modest annual tuition increase of 6% over the biennium, and then we're the tuition being paid down by paid internships, to me that just reminds me of a hamster wheel. We got the students running around in a vicious cycle. So on one hand, we're raising 6%, and then we're saying, well, apply for an internship, and we're going to buy down that tuition.
Chancellor Rosenstone.
Chair Pawlowski, members, I guess I don't accept the metaphor of the hamster wheel. The question is, do we want to create these experiences for our students, and do we want to use the dollars from that experience to kind of get twofers? The twofer for me is that it's helping protect on affordability, but we're also going to be in a position to give this experience to a student that if we didn't have the internship program, the student would not get that experience. We're trying to connect students to businesses in their local communities to help build the bridge to work that needs to be done in the community. So I'm trying to accomplish two things simultaneously, both worry about the affordability, but also create an experience which is good for the students, actually wanted by our students, and quite frankly, good for Minnesota.
Representative Franz.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think you and I are probably on the same page on this, so I'll just defer to you.
Representative Franz brings up an interesting point, and I'll rephrase her question this way. If we took the totality of the money that you have for paid internships, scholarships, and the state grant program, we applied it to tuition, what would your tuition increase be then? For every student, not just for the selected students that may benefit from one of these programs. What would happen if you took all of that and we applied it to your tuition? What would the tuition increase be?
I'm trying to do a little math in my head. It would probably be cut in half.
So, Chancellor Rosenstone, we could take that money and help all the students, or we could selectively help some of the students. And if the tuition increases continue to rise, so does the debt. If the tuition increases decrease, or there is no tuition increase, then we're also helping the debt issue. Because there are two issues here. The tuition increases have fed a debt monster simultaneously with these tuition increases.
Chair Pawlowski, there's lots of points of view on this. With respect to our part-time students, we'd be doing nothing to seriously impact their debt load because of the way the state grant is structured. That will continue to be a growing problem in the state, and changing from $145 to $72 in tuition increases is not going to make the same dent that changing the structure of the state grant program is going to make. This committee and the legislature is going to have to weigh the benefits that are being lost from not having the internships, which our students also champion, that businesses around the state champion, and that lead to students being better prepared for work. My role here is to try to balance this affordability and strategies for achieving the affordability with improving the quality of the experience we're providing our students and the quality of their education, and trying to meet this challenge we have of more students better prepared for work than ever before. That's the balancing act.
Chancellor, when I've had the student groups in my office at least twice, and then also met them on campus, and I phrased your question to them, would you rather have lower tuition for everyone, or should we start up new programs which would then require ongoing funding while your tuition continues to increase? Their answer is different from the one you just gave me. We can help a few, or we can help everyone. And I think the problem with higher ed has been, you've come before us repeatedly with new programs. I'm talking about the system now. And tuition has continued to increase. This is the first time we're having a serious discussion here about holding these tuition increases to as low as possible, or with the University of Minnesota, flat, helping everyone. Now, it may be a modest decrease to you, but to the student or to the individual that has to pay it, and if this policy would continue, that we would continue to target tuition and debt, I think we could see a whole different scenario in access and affordability. But how many new programs can we continue to fund and still increase tuition? Is there an answer to that question?
Chair Pawlowski, the balance will always have to be struck between improving the quality of what we're able to provide students and the cost. The largest reason for tuition going up over the last set of years are decisions that this legislature made to cut higher education, MINSQ, by $235 million over the last 4 years. As we discussed at our very first session together with this committee, 58% of dealing with that $235 million cut was dealt with cuts we made in administration, cuts we made in programs, salary freezes that everyone took across the system, layoffs, positions eliminated, programs eliminated, and 42% was borne by our students. But it was the decisions made by this legislature over the last two sessions, last two biennium, that produced the pressure on tuition. And we did the best we could with the hand we were dealt.
And for which your system raised not one complaint, nor did it anticipate the student debt, nor did... And frankly, and we've discussed this too, the gag order that was on even the presidents and the administrators at the local level prevented even legislators from being informed of the impact of this. So I've just been corrected that the $20 million you say is going to come out of private dollars, so we really couldn't use that. But even so, the argument is that if we take this money, whatever money we're going to get in the target, and we apply it to tuition rather than new program, tuition for everyone goes down, and I still think that's significant. Debt goes down for everyone rather than helping a few. And I just wonder why in the MINSQ central office that thought hadn't crossed anyone's mind, that holding tuition as low as you can get it and helping everyone wouldn't be the best outcome with very scarce resources. But that's an opinion. Rep. Sam Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as the author of the internship bill that you're not hearing, that I yet.
As I've told you, Representative, we are in possession of your bill.
You've reminded me of that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little surprised that we are talking about either or, because we have been starving education for a long time. And this legislature, we can't, you know, we have been pointing the finger at the institutions, and there's fair cause for that. But we also have to look at ourselves. And as a state, we have been providing less and less funding over the years since I've been here to our higher education institutions. I was one of the ones screaming on the House floor about the 19 and then lowered to 14% cuts. I still think it was the wrong thing to do, but I don't think it has to be either or. I think this state needs to improve and increase the amount of funds and support it gives to our schools, but I think also students need an internship opportunity. And Mr. Chair, you and I may disagree, and I understand you have control of my bill, but I would like to make the case, and I think the president already has, that there are experiences students get, particularly in rural Minnesota, that will encourage them to look at jobs in rural Minnesota, that will encourage them to try jobs that maybe they didn't try before. And not all learning occurs in the classroom, and this is a nice opportunity to provide a partnership between that academic knowledge and hands-on learning that occurs in a business and will support both the business and the student, both financially and academically. So I guess, I know you have my bill, but I do want to make the case for it doesn't have to be either or. We can do both. And I'm going to encourage you, Mr. Chair, while I have the microphone and before you hammer me out of order.
I'm not reaching for the gavel.
Good.
But I was thinking of reaching for something else. But that's okay.
But
see, and that wasn't your bill.
Darn. That this group around the table here give you a encouragement to fight for a good budget target, which I do not believe happened last year. In the last biennium, there was not that fighting for the higher ed funding, and I hope you will do that, and I'm encouraging you to do that, and let's get a good budget target, and let's do both.
Well, Representative Norton, your bill illustrates an interesting point. It's sponsored by the Coalition of Minnesota Cities. It's a tax credit. The mayor of Winona called me Sunday advocating for your bill, and I said, well, first of all, Chair Lincheski isn't thrilled with the idea of tax credits for everyone, and I think I'm sitting on over $100 million of various tax credits that she isn't going to take off her bottom line, or do I wish to have credited back to my account. But I said, you know, Mayor Peterson, the choice is an interesting one. You have $11 million in that bill that you want to see spent, and we need to get the money from somewhere, so I suggest we take it from local government aid. And at that, he seemed to be disagreeable. He said, no, it shouldn't come out of local government aid, not there, because local government aid is our number one priority. And I said, well, Mayor Peterson, you haven't talked to me about local government aid. You're calling me about funding a new program when local government aid cuts should be restored, because they do police, fire, water, streets, repairs, a whole array of things that make sure regional centers like Rochester and Winona have those services for people. So it's interesting again. And then when I ask the students, do you want to see tuition lowered for everyone, or do you want it for a few? And apparently that question was never raised. That's why I brought it up. I think the discussion has to be now. If we can get tuition under control, which also gets debt under control. And if we're going to have your program, why not the next one and the next one? And now we're up to $100 million. And what's tuition going to be if we have to fund that? So this is the core discussion before us. Do we help everyone and get the beast under control, or do you start adding new funding programs and increase tuition simultaneously? I would argue it's got to stop. And tuition and debt have to be the priority to restore affordability and access to higher education. And at least the university recognizes it. Representative Norton.
And Mr. Chair, I agree with you about keeping tuition low, and I've been fighting for that, as have most of the people around this table that care enough about this issue to serve on the committee. So we are not in disagreement there. I would say, while we're having this great discussion around this table, this is a bigger issue. This is about our state budget. Not just about the higher education budget. I'm asking you to fight for a good target for the higher education, and I'm asking the people around this table and in this state to support a better state budget so that we don't have to continue to starve the beast, because it does affect all of our lives.
Well, Representative Norton, right now I'm the chief author of the only two bills that does that. Representative Friend.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to say that that you illustrated my point very eloquently. And also, just to the committee members and also to the chancellor, we have to stop playing the blame game. Here we are looking into the future. We can continue looking in the past and pointing fingers to the past, but that's not going to fix the issue of what we got going on, which is higher tuition, and the experience for the students is going to be very grim when they get that debt load, and they're going to say, why did I even bother trying to better my education, because what did it cost me? And it's costing them an experience with having to pay a huge, huge debt load that sometimes equals their mortgage payment. So that's what we have to look at.
Chair Pawlowski,
Chancellor,
one way to get to move this conversation forward would be say, but we're very happy. I would be very happy with my board's permission, which I don't have, but I'll speak for myself, to amend our request for the investment plus $78 million to hold tuition at zero. And so think of this not as a either-or situation, as Representative Norton was suggesting, that it's not do we make investments in improving the quality of the education, do we make investments in helping meet the workforce needs of Minnesota, do we make investments to ensure that students can graduate in a more timely fashion. Not either-or, but we need to make both sets of investments. Investments to meet our challenge of meeting workforce needs of Minnesota, as well as investments on affordability. Now, our situation is a little different than the other systems. The 430,000 students. 88% of our students are Minnesotans. We're not talking about a third or a half of our tuition revenue. We're talking about close to 100% of our tuition revenue. The economics are fundamentally different. We don't have additional revenue streams which are off the table, which are permitted to grow, because we're just focusing on a portion of our revenue streams for Minnesota students. So our finances are quite different. We're very comfortable that the committee would want to consider the $78 million plus the $97 million investments in quality of the programs, meeting workforce needs, as well as investments in holding tuition constant. If that's the route the committee wants to go, we'd be happy to work with you on that.
And Chancellor, to do what the governor does, he raises $3.7 billion, as you've already heard with President Kaler there. What level of revenue do you think we should raise to just fund what you stated?
Chair Pawlowski, I can only here speak for myself. Our board has not taken a position.
I realize that, but you are here, and you're speaking for the Minsky system.
On this matter, our board has not taken a position on revenue, so I cannot speak for the system. I can only speak for myself. Personally, I think this is one of the best investments Minnesota can make. There is no better payoff to Minnesota from investing in its human capital, and there is no strategy that's going to ensure Minnesota's prosperity more rigorously than an investment in its human capital. There is no plan B. And if we fail to make those hard investments in protecting our future, we will pay an even higher price down the road.
Well, Chancellor, to Representative Norton's point, I think the Minsky Board of Trustees better start fighting for higher education and for a greater revenue increase. And if the answer is your board has not taken a position, then it better start taking a position on the amount of revenue that should be raised here to support your budget request. And if we want to add another $78 million to it, then they better start taking a position on that too. Because I think the time is over when you can come and just expect, here, give us the money, but don't take any position on where it comes from. There are going to be tough choices here on revenue. And Representative Norton, this is to Representative Norton's other point. You were out of the room, and there was a statement about not fighting for higher education. And Representative Norton knows this better than anyone else. You have to deal with the target you get, and you do the best you can with it. And you have been given some harsh targets, very harsh ones. You did the best you could with what you had. I think this time we may get a little bit better target, hopefully. And I'm also hopefully that the Board of Trustees will assist us in raising the revenue needed to support their request. And if their answer is they can't, that is a very poor answer from the trustees, that they can't make a statement on how much revenue should be raised here to support their own budget request. Representative Norton.
Mr. Chair, just to respond, you aren't dealing with a $5 or $6 billion deficit, so you're in a better position
right
than we have been in the last few years. So, yeah, maybe more revenue needs to be raised, but it's far less of an emergency than it has been, and I'm just stating that for the record.
And Representative Nornes, we should use these resources as preciously as we can, and perhaps not spending new, but trying to repair the damage is where we should go. Representative Franz.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, Mr. Chair. So we have the Chancellor saying that higher education is the most important investment we can make, where I also serve on early education. Representative Winkler also serves on early education, and we're hearing that early education is the most important investment we can make, and here we are going to be making new programs for early education, a new department for early education. Just your thoughts on that, because, hey, I would not have a problem, you know, fixing some funds and moving into higher education personally. But what would you, I mean, there's just this two dichotomies, so early education, higher education.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, I think the phrase I used was investment in the state's human capital is the most important investment that can be made. Chair Pawlowski attended a hearing on February 19th, convened by two of your colleagues, which focused on building the world's best workforce. And the way that that committee structured the conversations over, I think, the 2.5 hours we were all together was, if you will, from cradle to grave. It was not thinking that there's one place you can invest and it's the silver bullet that saves everything, but rather it's an investment that has to occur at each step along the pipeline. Our ability, for example, to succeed in higher education, going back, I think, to a question that was anticipated by Representative Poppe's earlier comment, our ability to succeed in higher education very much depends on the hand that we are dealt, the kind of students that we get. The better prepared students are, the better job we're going to do, the more successful we're going to be. Our ability to move them through in a very timely fashion and prepare them in even more glorious ways is much easier. We need to think about the entire system. So I would make the case that that entire system has to be working, and there is no better investment we can be making as a state than in our human resources.
Representative Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the Chancellor said some of what I was going to say. It is definitely a continuum of investment from early childhood through post-secondary. And our future does depend on the human capital investment, and we ought not to be pitting early childhood against higher education. And I think too often the legislature has pitted K-12 investment against higher education and compromised on the target for higher education in favor of K-12, partly for political reasons. And I think that's a tragedy, and I think part of that is the debt our students are carrying as a result of those choices. And I hope that we don't box ourselves into the same place again with our targets.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I guess I appreciate the amount of time that we've had to spend in these committees understanding exactly what these budgets are and understanding what the impact of policy decisions are on students and tuition. Chancellor Rosenstone, of course, is correct that our future prosperity depends on the quality of our workforce and its education. But it's also true that our education levels are much higher than they were in the past. And our wealth is much greater than it is in the past, but people are not seeing the kind of wage growth that they have seen in the past, and that is in part what drives this concern about tuition. The number of hours that were necessary to work to earn the amount of tuition at minimum wage is substantially greater now than it was in the glory days when we had a lot less money as a society. So I think part of this concern about tuition and productivity growth relates to the diminished economic opportunities that a lot of people are facing because of the way the economy and labor force are currently structured. So, yes, it is important to invest in education and human capital and productivity throughout the system, but we have to be mindful of where money is coming from, because if we're asking people to pay for it who are not seeing the benefits of their productive potential and their productivity growth, then we are essentially just further subsidizing the top end of the economic ladder, the ones who are gaining all the value from that productivity increase, and asking those at the bottom to pay for it. And I think that, for me, is where a huge part of the concern about tuition comes from. And I think it's very important that Minsky, I don't agree with the chair that you're supposed to take a position on revenue, but I do think you are supposed to be as bold as you need to be in order to say what needs to happen to make our higher education system deliver a higher quality workforce and do it at an affordable price. We need to know both of those equations in order to, I think, make wise decisions about revenue. We'll do that in a different committee, Mr. Chair. Hopefully. Or somebody else would do that in a different committee. We'll be happy to spend it.
Well, I would like to see Minsky take a position on something once in a while. If it's not increasing revenue, it's at least telling us that it's harmful to cut. And under the previous administration, the only thing we got out of that chancellor was, we can handle it. And they didn't. Students did. and the debt reflects it. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to belabor this, the point, but I'll use Representative Ansel's comment on the House floor in the previous session when we were considering reform to our permit process here in the state of Minnesota. He got up and said, and I'm paraphrasing, that if we had the environmentalist regulations in force back in that we have today, back during World War II, when we needed to get iron ore out to build the weapons in order to win World War II, we would not have been able to get the iron ore out of the ground with the current environmentalist regulations. So I guess what I'm saying is we're holding back one of the most prosperous states in the nation with extremist taxes and regulations that discourage our productivity that doesn't help the environment that much. And I had one last comment. This is mine, not Representative Ansel's. The man-made global warming theory has turned out to be a United Nations fraud and scam. And unfortunately, that philosophy is creating an extremist agenda in our DNR and MPCA that is thwarting the growth of our private sector, which could generate hundreds of millions of billions of dollars to meet the needs that we have before us today. Thank you.
Chancellor, we're going to pause here. We'll have you back on Monday, I hope, to conclude this. And Representative Doyle, you have a motion?
I move to pass the minutes of March 11th.
Representative Doyle moves the minutes of March 11th. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Chancellor. We'll see you on Monday. Meeting is adjourned.